I'm Brian Roth, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. This episode is part of a series of interviews recorded in December at Salute Sourfest, an annual beer festival hosted in Charlotte, North Carolina. The event attracts a curated selection of skilled sour-making breweries from around the country with a heavy presence from the Mid-Atlantic region. Sourfest represents a kind of festival that's rapidly growing in popularity, where attending breweries often run in the same circles or share a like-minded ethos, making for a special occasion for attendees instead of an event with any and every brewery that would care to send a keg. As drinkers sipped on a variety of wild and sour beers, I was able to pull a collection of brewers and business owners aside for brief conversations about their companies, specialties, and what's catching their eye in the industry. This episode and others run about 20 to 25 minutes, so we had time to dig in a little bit, but the interviews are a bit more focused than the free-ranging talks you hear most weeks here on the podcast. This episode features Jason Pellett, founder and brewmaster of Atlanta's Orpheus Brewing. Listen in.
Speaking of kind of the quirkiness of Georgia laws, what goes on with beer in that state is both kind of foreign and very exciting and strange to me.
Yeah.
In all of the ways that those words may be defined. For you, so you guys have been open since 2014?
Yep.
At Orpheus? Yep. How have the changing laws kind of impacted this? Now we're going back just months at this point.
Yeah.
How has that impacted the way that you're thinking about and handling your business?
I mean, it, you know, it really gives us a reason to, build up the tasting room experience itself. So we've concentrated on barrel aged beers from the beginning, but had a hard time justifying actually pouring them during the tours when everybody was just paying a flat rate for a few tickets. And so we eventually actually started doing our house beer Noise and Flesh just so we could have a barrel aged beer that is on tap. But other than that, we didn't pour our barrel-aged beers on tap. So now we actually open up a whole new room in the brewery with a barrel bar. And so we can really concentrate on growing that side of it. I mean, that was my argument to our distributor. Was like, you know, you should support this because we can grow our brand this way in a way that, you know, breweries in other states do. Like, they're destinations. And
support changing the law,
right?
You mean? Yeah, yeah.
And they could see that. They ended up going along with it and supporting it. But, you know, kind of that, it just wasn't like that in Georgia. There were no real destination breweries in Georgia because you couldn't create a destination experience.
Mm-hmm. How are you doing that for Orpheus?
One is just taking all the barrel-aged beers that we've done from the beginning and actually serving them at the brewery. instead of sending them all off elsewhere.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that makes it, it's really kind of hard to justify all the barrel aging we were doing when it's all going into distribution because then you don't make any money. Mm-hmm. So.
What was the curve that you had to work with in terms of creating that kind of beer, not having the ability to talk about it and educate like others do in their physical space?
I mean, it was, I used to tell people on tours when we'd get to the barrel room, I was like, I consider this the law change room. It was definitely an investment in the future, knowing that, you know, it was inevitable that at some point the laws would change. So we were just going to do the stuff that we wanted to do from the beginning and let the laws catch up.
One of the things that caught my eye about the background for you and getting involved in the brewery was how does a trumpet player come to be a brewer specializing in barrel-aged beers?
Man, there was a, I didn't realize how consequential this date was at the time, but March 18th, 2009 was the date of my master's trumpet recital. Went to the Brick Store afterwards, and I was already pretty into beer. But had my first sour beer that night, just asked the bartender for a recommendation, and it was Duchess. And that was the day that everything kind of turned around. I didn't know it that day, but just got really obsessed with sour beers and just all the process into making them. And I wasn't brewing at the time. It was just kind of a, as a drinker, an obsession. And eventually I was like, why am I not brewing? Like, as a hobby, I was like, I know too much to not do this myself. So started that, and just, I was ready to change careers. So 15 years of freelance trumpet playing was enough. So just kind of developed Orpheus as a fantasy, like, because it's, you know, I had trumpet player money, so it was never going to happen.
Trumpet player money is not amazing money.
It is not.
Just to confirm.
Right. That is not the money to build a capital-intensive business.
So, for the kind of work and creation that you had in the music side of your career, mm-hmm. how does that impact the way that you do your work now?
I mean, it's, you know, so my degrees are in classical playing, actually, and it's very methodical, you know, taking, you know, a single measure of music or even less than that and approaching it from every different angle to make sure that when you get there, there's no way it goes wrong. And so that's kind of how I really try to think about building beer. But that's, in many ways, that actually was more of a, that approach is how I was able to open a brewery with no experience. I didn't know what I was doing, but here I'm, you know, laying out a brewery and figuring out how it's all going to work. And it was that same process of, like, if you just break the whole building a brewery into very small steps and, approach, make sure that you understand every single one of those steps, approach it from all angles, and then it's if you break it down like that, it's hard to go wrong. So
what made you feel most comfortable opening up, taking that idea, bringing it to life, and doing that in Georgia?
Oh man, well, Georgia at the time, and this was, it's hard to believe now with the amazing beer in Georgia right now, but there was really when I first started. So we opened 3.5 years ago, and this was lucky connections through the owners of the Porter Beer Bar, actually, was how I found initial investors. So 5.5 to 6 years ago, the brewery scene in Georgia was very different than it is now, and there was just, you know, you could tell from how successful places like the Porter and the Brick Store were that they were very serious drinkers. It was just the breweries that were there at the time just weren't catering to that kind of drinker. I was like, well, somebody could, and it could be me. So, it was obviously risky to open with a flagship sour. We opened with 2 sours and a Saison, and that's it. But I just, you know, I'd share the beer with beer drinkers, non-beer drinkers, whatever, and people liked it. If you don't tell people that you need to be an experienced beer drinker to like sour beer, people like it. If you build it up as this, like, special thing, you have to have a mature palate, then it turns people off. So we never took that approach. It was just, if you like wine, if you like cocktails, if you like beer, you know, This is something that's just, it tastes good. So,
do you see that as something that was more challenging given the recent history and what was available to drinkers in Georgia and perhaps where that demographic was versus elsewhere in the country?
It was a stretch. I mean, Atalanta was definitely lots of people's in Georgia first sour beer. And there were, in the first year or so, there was a whole lot of, like, beer buyers from different bars and restaurants would come in and love the beer, order some, but then they didn't know. It took education from us to the actual bars on how to talk about the beer, because they would order the beer because they liked it, and then it would go on the menu as just, it's just a beer. And then people would order it not knowing what to expect and send it back.
Really? So how much extra work did that end up being for you in terms of having to make that connection with the direct salespeople at bars, restaurants, whatever?
That was, you know what? I wasn't actually very involved.
You had the easy job.
I would do that to some extent, but you know, I'm not somebody who goes out to accounts right. like beyond the, you know, beer specialty accounts that I'm already comfortable with. I'm not a salesperson. I'm not a
as the artist behind it, as it were.
Uh-huh.
In creating the beers, especially like you said, releasing what was probably local drinkers' first exposure to mm-hmm. something that would be sour, wild,
right.
or something like that. What goes through your mind in the way that you're thinking about the recipe to create something that you know has to be a positive first experience?
So Atalanta was the first, and that was actually, that came from my home brew, and it was, I brewed the beer that was called, well, we retired Lyric Ale a few months ago, but that, I brewed that and then Atalanta back to back as a home brewer, and I was like, oh, those two beers could be the core of a brewery. And I wasn't really thinking about sales. It was just like, this is a vision here and I can build from that. And I've never really approached developing beers like, what do people want? It's more like, there's gaps and I'm gonna fill the gaps because I want them. And I've always, even as homebrew, I was like, why would I brew a beer that I can actually just go buy a similar version of on the shelf? That's just a waste of time. You know, it's, homebrewing is a, some people think they'll get into homebrewing because it's cheap. That is
for not, those homebrewers who do it long enough.
Not the cheap way to get beer.
you learn your lesson fairly quickly.
So yeah, so it's like, for me, it's always, there's a lot of things that I like, but I'm only going to brew the ones that you can't already get, mm-hmm. just because, well, I can't get them and I want them.
Where are those gaps now in the way that you kind of look at ways to fill them?
Now the gaps are, I mean, so back then there was a definite sour gap. Mm-hmm. Now the gaps are more subtle, or as far as I see. I don't see any big stylistic gaps in what's available, but there's a huge range of possible, I mean, not just sour, but, you know, I think about sour beers a lot. Lots of possible flavors, you know, as much as non-sour, really. And there's just... there's just a lot of room in between, you know, in the way that non-sour beer is developed, with huge gradients within, you know, individual styles. And there's a lot more room for that in sour beer, of just, you know, full spectrum of flavors that, you know, are gradually being filled in.
So the landscape is much different now because, like you're saying, that gap in various ways has been filled. Where are you finding inspiration then for the beers that you make, but also taking into consideration that you have to pivot slightly from that, is so you aren't just repeating something that's already out there?
Right. We take actually a lot of inspiration from what we already do, and we take, well, we like what we did here, and we can explore that in various ways.
Could you give me an example?
So we just started, doing a series of wild IPAs that take from our, we call our mother. It's actually the wild culture that sours beers like Atalanta. So it's a lot of people would call it a kettle sour, but we started actually doing it spontaneously at the beginning. And so that would take days, sometimes 5 to 7 days for the wort to sour. So we started repitching that wild stuff batch to batch, and eventually it made everything, it actually evolved very nicely and made everything more consistent. And it's a very diverse culture. So when we sour beers, we do it hot enough that the yeast isn't active, but there's actually a lot of yeast in that culture, so we can ferment beers with it. So we started using that in IPAs. The hops actually inhibit the bacteria in it, so we can brew wild IPAs with this that are not sour, but they just have that wild character. So getting that kind of house character in as much of our stuff as possible is kind of the next direction we're trying to go.
And that is reflected only in those wild IPAs, or is that it's being sought to bring into other things?
It's in the wild IPAs. It's we do some barrel aged sours that have that use that culture for their whole fermentation. Actually, one of the beers we have here, Blackberry Noise and Flesh, we actually sour the wort with the mother and then put it into open fermenters and let it ferment with the mother and then put it into barrels. Mm-hmm.
Finding ways to do that, maybe the IPA series is a good example. How is it that you are exploring these kinds of ways to push yourself now that you've had the brewery for some time and you've got your base both in terms of what you have accomplished as well as what people expect of you, and then taking that to the next step about ways that you can continue to expand what you're capable of?
Mm-hmm. That's tough, and sometimes you feel like, wow, I don't have any more ideas. I remember when I was a kid, when I was first starting to get into music, I was blown away by the idea of writing music. Like, how it's only 11 notes, you know? It's like, how are the songs not all already written? And, you know, and then I actually started writing and teaching how to compose music, and it's like, there's so much room for exploration even with a very limited, you know, palette. But sometimes run into, you know, it ebbs and flows, you know. There's a reason that you see musicians, bands and stuff take breaks, you know. There's very creative periods and then nothing, and then it comes back. So which is okay from my perspective, because I do so much in the brewery that, you know, being able to come in and out of trying to create new stuff is a nice place to be. I'll go through a period where I'm coming up with a lot of stuff that's really cool and really exciting for me. And then that kind of gets moving, and I have to, at that point, I've gotten behind on other stuff I have to do. Go back to that stuff for a while, and then working on the, I guess, what I would consider more boring parts of running a brewery. Eventually it get really fidgety and like stuff starts coming to me again, then I have to push the stuff that I've almost gotten caught up on out of the way and get back to trying to create some stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's just I don't really have a process. It just, things just, I'll get one little idea and then it just goes. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's, to put it in the best analogy, perhaps, it's the improvisation aspect of music, I guess.
Right.
Right? You wait to see what inspires you, and then you just run with it.
Right. And sometimes it'll be, it'll be one small idea, or just, like, think about a specific ingredient, and then go from there. So I'm never trying to be like, I have to come up with something, but it'll be, it's like, oh, I had an opportunity to just pick up a bunch of rye barrels. What am I going to do with that? And once you start to think about, well, I have rye barrels. What do I do with that? And then it just grows from there instead of trying to just force something to happen. You see that. That's a way that I think is great, and a way that I would teach kids to compose is you don't have to have a whole idea when you start. Actually, if you think you're going to have a whole filled out idea, you're never going to start, because it's for most people, that's not how it works. It's like, I would teach motivic composition. So it's like, you know, you can start with a very simple idea, you know, like da 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 dum, you know, and build a symphony from that. But if you think you're going to come up with the whole symphony from the beginning, you're not going to even get to that first motive.
And in this case, it's taking particular ingredient or a type of barrel, as you were talking about, and then letting that kind of sit and then figuring out where it takes your mind?
Yes. I mean, that's a very common way that it's been happening for me recently. I mean, there's a few specific beers that I've come up with that were like, I know this is exactly what I want, but a lot of it really does come from a specific ingredient or barrel or something like that, some small inspiration that can build from there.
So if you're giving an ingredient, are you then, is it your process, you're scribbling in a notebook, or is it literally, say, you're just cleaning around the brew house until something just kind of clicks for you?
Or more likely I'll be laying in bed, not sleeping.
I think that's how a lot of good ideas end up, like, when you're not thinking about things.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, this is why I don't sleep, because I'm always thinking about things.
So, thinking about how that works for you, is there something that has you most excited right now, looking at kind of what may be inspiring you at the moment?
So we got these rye barrels, and so we have one of our sour beers. It's called Minotaur. It's a whiskey barrel sour. And so just decided with the rye, Manhattans are my favorite drinks. So just going to go something, it's almost obvious, except want to go a little extreme with it, with just take our Minotaur, put it in rye barrels, and just ridiculous amounts of cherries. Because I love that, you know, that Fredriksdal cherry wine, like that huge, just intense cherry character. So I want almost that cherry character in the rye barrels with the base sour.
Cool. Well, I hope you find much more inspiration and all sorts of other things. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for listening, folks. If you'd like to hear more from this series, we've got 5 interviews in total, all available on the Good Beer Hunting website. If you'd like to support GBH, join our Fervent Few community. You can learn more at patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. That's patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. As part of the community, you get access to a host of perks, in addition to sharing your voice with those of us on the GBH editorial team. We're so thankful for the support, encouragement, and inspiration of the Fervent Few and what they offer beer lovers too. That's going to be it for this week. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.